Welcome to Illinois Family Spotlight, a conversation about issues of the day from a biblical perspective, as well as highlights from interviews, conferences, and events. Here's Monty Larrick.
Thanks for making Illinois Family Spotlight part of your day. The Illinois Family Institute is joining with other life-affirming organizations in opposition to the End of Life Options Act. This pro-suicide legislation is under consideration in the Illinois General Assembly. While proponents are promising strict safeguards to counter abuse, IFI and other opponents warn that should the legislation become law, it could easily be expanded to cover non-terminal conditions and even children, bringing alarming Oregon, California, and Canada-style legal suicide to Illinois. For this edition of Spotlight, highlights from an interview with Nancy Valco. Ms. Valco served for more than 50 years as a registered nurse. She's a spokeswoman for the National Association of Pro-Life Nurses. You can read her blogs at nancyvalco.com. We begin with her response to a question about the dangers of doctors and medical organizations being neutral on legal suicide.
On the issue of assisted suicide, neutrality kills. What do you mean by that?
The problem is, if doctors themselves don't take a position on the most important issue they have, the most important covenant they have with their patients is that they will not kill them, what else is open? When you have that, then you allow people who are willing to do it free rein. It's very important that doctors stay up and they say, we will not kill our patients. When you have neutrality, you're telling people, we don't care that much about it. And if we don't care as medical people, why should the public? And it showed to kill, too, in both Oregon and California. Things changed when their medical associations took a position of neutrality.
Speaking of Oregon and California, they have assisted suicide, pro-euthanasia laws. What's the likelihood of that happening here in Illinois?
Very high. And it really does make a difference in how we trust doctors and what doctors are allowed to do. There's real problems with the assisted suicide laws that aren't being spoken about publicly and that the media is not interested in, such as the secrecy involved, the self-reporting. They say, oh, it's going beautifully. But when you look at the few doctors who do it, who can do a whole lot of people in, they basically are called in when the doctor doesn't want to, the patient's own doctor doesn't want to. They come in, they meet the person who they've never met before. Their specialty could be dermatology. Supposedly, they can evaluate the qualifications of this person for assisted suicide, write the prescription. They are not required to be there, and they make out a form relying on self-reporting for the state. We don't allow this kind of secrecy in capital murder executions. Lethal injections, you can't do that. Everything is stripped of oversight and of transparency. They keep everything secret, and even worse, the cause of death, particularly in Oregon, they make the doctors put down some underlying condition rather than the real thing of assisted suicide. And they're very concerned about this, so they've tried to change the terminology. It's not suicide. It's not like suicide. It is like suicide. It's exactly suicide. It's suicide with the doctor's help. And it does make a difference. But they actually, in Washington, one doctor said, they're making me falsify a document, a legal document. And when we're letting this happen, what happens to actuarial scales? What happens to research? We don't know really what happens when we rely on secrecy and self-reporting by the doctors.
What is the federal agenda of pro-assisted suicide, pro-euthanasia groups such as Compassion and Choices?
Well, it's important for people to realize Compassion and Choices actually started out in 1938, was the origin of the movement. It was called then the Euthanasia Society of America, and it was working to get lethal injections legalized. And they didn't get very far, particularly after the truth about the Nazi Holocaust came out, where they not only killed Jews, but also the disabled in Nazi Germany. And it fell into disfavor. And what happened is these groups kind of started to change their names. All of a sudden, we had the Society for the Right to Die and the invention of the living will. That was kind of the resurrection of the euthanasia movement. And Lewis Kuntner, who's a lawyer from Chicago, was the guy who invented it and wrote a paper on this. And it was called A Good First Step Towards Increasing Public Acceptance of Euthanasia, and has more than done that. So those things morphed in, Hemlock Society was there, and now we have a conglomerate called Compassion and Choices.
New Planned Parenthood?
Which I said is really kind of positioned to become the new Planned Parenthood, only this time of death. Their 2015 financial report shows that they have $24 million over in assets. Pro-life groups work with volunteer donations. It has a vendetta against the Catholic Church, who they consider that and disability activists as their primary opponents. They're very good with the media. Since Brittany Maynard, they insisted on having it called not assisted suicide, but aid in dying. They've been trying different terms. And polls have found when you use the word suicide, all of a sudden the support for assisted suicide drops. Suicide is a horrible thing. One of my children committed suicide at the age of 30 using an assisted suicide technique that she learned about from this group, from the groups of people promoting it.
What are some of the precursors for states adopting assisted suicide and pro-euthanasia laws? What happened in the run-up?
They're very well organized, and with all the publicity and people like us who say, this doesn't work all that well, and this leads to that and all sorts of problems, and Canada legalized it, and they're talking about mentally ill people. It's not about terminal illness. It's not about pain. It's about people's right to choose death. Not choose death for whatever reason. And the goal actually is assisted suicide, euthanasia on demand. And Derek Humphrey of the Hemlock Society has been very open about that, and he said we will have euthanasia. And he said one of the reasons is because we have older people that we can't afford. The economics of it will make it inevitable.
That leads me to ask you this. Could we see healthcare rationing that would lead to assisted suicide and euthanasia?
It very well can, and on their website, Compassion and Choices has their federal policy agenda, and most of it has to do with getting federal funding for activities for education in as palliative care. The American Association of Hospice and Palliative Care has taken a position of neutrality on assisted suicide. And most patients in Oregon and the other states that commit assisted suicide come from hospice. So they've been very involved. There's quite a thing there. They know who to call. They have an 800 number. And that happens, and they're also talking about not reimbursing or even punitively challenging, quote, inappropriate care without defining what inappropriate is. And as we know, people with Alzheimer's and the so-called persistent vegetative state are often considered just hopeless. The best thing for them is to die.
Here in Illinois, they've watered down our Right of Conscience Act. Doesn't that just play into the hands of the pro-euthanasia, pro-assisted suicide folks?
Well, people are falling for it. And what's interesting is the abortion clinics don't have to get information about the pregnancy centers, which is kind of interesting. When you look at that, what you've got are, and we look at Planned Parenthood, they're very well protected. They're supported by the media. And Compassion and Choices is getting to that point, too, where they kind of manage what's happening and being able to promote this. But the ground's already been tilled. People have gotten used to the right to die. They go, well, if I'm in a lot of pain, people aren't. I've been a hospice nurse. I've been an oncology nurse, an ICU nurse, a burn unit nurse. You don't have to have pain. But they have the specter that natural death is automatically agonizing. Like I have friends, I said, if your loved one is dying and there's a problem, call me. Call me. I'll tell you what to ask, the questions to ask, and the things to talk about. I research this stuff all the time. I've taken care of my terminally ill mother with cancer. She died without even needing Tylenol, even though the cancer was in her neck and she had to have a tracheostomy. This can be done, but we're being sold a bill of goods. The usual CPR that we use and everybody should know about it is being portrayed to older people as something you don't want. We could break your ribs. Most of the time it doesn't work. We have a different language for people we don't consider lives as worthy as. And people are starting to fall for it, and they go, well, I'd like it if I get it. The problem is they're going to get it even when they don't want it. And that's what the disability people say. Not Dead Yet has been wonderful. And they talk about it. They said when they go into a hospital, they're constantly said, want to sign a living will? Every day. Want to sign a living will? They're being talked into, well, you don't want that. And I have seen that happen. And I've seen the bias that comes about because of that. And this is basically an elitist view. But I like to reassure people, we can control your pain and your symptoms. I spent almost 50 years doing it. Don't fall for the thing that we'd have to kill you. And we're being killed by doctors who have more in common with Jack Kevorkian than with Marcus Welby, the iconic.
You mentioned living wills. Can we choose life in a living will?
Well, I actually have a blog where I discuss many of these things. I have a blog called Living with a Living Will. Because the language in there, people don't know. They're signing up and checking off things like food and water, ventilators, without really knowing what they're doing. And I said, would you sign an operation permit without the operation being on it, or what the circumstances were? And they go, ooh. I said, you trust that? It's not necessarily your doctor's going to be making the decision. Find out what's going on. My advance directive, I designate my husband, and I put in there, I don't check off anything. My husband knows my wishes. He will make the decision. He is to be given all facts and all options. And that's the part that people don't realize. They go, oh. And this is an actual case that happened. The danger of this is there was a young man who was in a car accident, and he was concussed. He was knocked out, and both of his lungs collapsed. And the wife was there, and they put him on a ventilator, and they said, we've got to put chest tubes in to reinflate his lungs. She said, but my husband said no tubes. No, I never want tubes. And they go, lady, he's got virtually 100% chance. He's going to wake up from this concussion, but we need to inflate his lungs or he'll die. She goes, but he said he didn't want tubes. And the doctors didn't put tubes in, and the young man died. This is what I'm talking about.
You also mentioned people with disabilities, and for the disabled, they have to be very, very leery of this whole right-to-die pro-euthanasia movement.
They really do. Not Dead Yet is a really great organization, not religiously affiliated, not, you know, with pro-lifers or anything else. They have their own thing. And having had a daughter with Down syndrome, and seeing the bias when she was made a do not resuscitate against my express wishes and behind my back, I understand what they're talking about. But it's interesting how things are portrayed according to age. These wonderful medical advances, when someone's older, it's portrayed entirely different, if they're even allowed to talk about what kind of procedures. People don't understand what ventilators are. One time I had an elderly man who needed a ventilator for pneumonia. Short time, you know, I explained it to the family and everything else. They got so comfortable with it, they go, well, that's not life support. I said, it exactly is. But I explained what it was, what we were doing it for, what we expected to happen. And they were very comfortable with it. If that man had checked off ventilators on his advance directive, who knows what could have happened? They go, well, legally, if he was unconscious, or they thought maybe he was demented. You know, you're really opening yourself up to possible abuse. And like I said, informed consent is informed consent. You wouldn't sign an operating permit without knowing everything, what could happen, what was there. That's very important. With euthanasia-assisted suicide, not so much.
What can people of faith, individuals do to counter this drive toward legalized euthanasia and assisted suicide?
They need to educate themselves. That is one of the biggest things, and it's such a big subject. That many people are intimidated, and this is why I do what I do, because I feel so strongly. There's a place called euthanasia.com. It has links to state organizations, pro-life organizations, articles on all sorts of stuff that people can do, and they can get involved. There's the Pro-Life Healthcare Alliance, which has all sorts of information, a brochure called Informed, where it talks about feeding tubes and ventilators and all this stuff, and talks about what they really do. And also, I have a blog, which I write on many of these issues, and I try to, in a short period of time, take one issue at a time and explain it. But once you get educated, then you have to speak out and speak up. And people are intimidated into silence nowadays because it is not politically correct. And I have done debates with people on the other side, including a vice president of the Hemlock Society. And I said, listen, I'd love to be on the politically correct side. You tell me. Convince me. Where am I wrong? and now no one even debates me. Because, you know, that's the thing. I said, I'm willing to do it. I'd like to be on the politically right side. But you get down to the fact is we don't cause or hasten death. And in the 60s and 70s, we were terrified as doctors and nurses. We no more wanted to do that, even inadvertently. It would just be devastating. And now the right to die is so big, they don't care. There's a lot of people who just don't care, and they start kind of bending the rules, and like the man I talked about that wouldn't stop breathing when they took him off the ventilator, and the doctor goes, well, you know, he wants to be made comfortable. Keep increasing his medicine until he stops breathing. The medicine would stop his breathing, and it did.
Well, when people vote, know what the candidates stand for in terms of the right to die and all this?
It's very important. And one thing I've told people, you know, when they say, oh, you're single issue, I said, I'm majority issue. I want to see what they say about life. If they're not good on that, how could they possibly be good on anything else? And I have my own economic ideas. I was on a healthcare reform task force in 2003, working with a think tank in Washington. We came up with tremendous ideas to cover the poor. It wouldn't have cost things. It wouldn't have been an Obamacare or Hillary care. It was absolutely great. There was money there to do it. And then the Iraq war broke out. But we have it, and we still have what we came up with. Vouchers to the poor, that once they use it up, it was catastrophic insurance. They would cover after that, but they could use it for whatever. That has been fought. They don't really like people to make their own decisions because they're not sure they'd make the right ones. And maybe they'd put off to save the money. They'd put off having preventative care. We're adults. Let people make their own decisions. I am not a Republican or a Democrat. I don't go into that stuff at all. On my blog, I do not discuss politics. I discuss health care. But to me, if they're not right on health care, which includes assisted suicide and abortion, they don't have my vote.
How can people get connected with Nancy Valco?
Well, I have a blog at nancyvalco.com. It's N-A-N-C-Y, V as in Victor, A-L-K-O.com, one word, Nancy Valco, where they can read things and they can contact me through there. They can give comments on what I wrote, and they can contact me that way. I'm notified every time there's a comment on there, and I'm more than happy to help.
Thank you so much. God bless.
Thank you. God bless you, too.
Nancy Valco with the National Association of Pro-Life Nurses. You can read her blogs at nancyvalco.com. That's Valco with a K. Call your state lawmakers. Ask them to vote no on the Pro-Suicide End-of-Life Options Act. For names and phone numbers, go to IllinoisFamily.org and click Officials Finder. Now, after time out, a short interview with pro-life apologist Scott Klusendorf.
Gender, a social construct? This is Ken Ham, the president of the ministry behind the Answers Bible curriculum. What is a woman? Well, that's a question previous generations had no trouble answering. An adult human female. But now many people claim they can't define a woman. Why? Well, because they believe gender is just a social construct and biology tells us nothing about a person. But biology does matter, because God created our biology. And His word is clear. We're created as either male or female. Gender isn't just something people invented. It was created by God. Now, of course, sin distorts everything, including gender, but the truth is our identity isn't based in feelings.
Want to know more about the gospel of Jesus Christ and the importance of a literal Adam? Visit us at AnswersRadio.com to learn more. There are more answers at AnswersRadio.com.
Join the Illinois Family Institute along with Dr. Brad Wilcox and Scott Phelps for their powerful, practical insights on the high calling of marriage and families at IFI's Worldview Conference, Saturday, March 8th at Belmont Bible Church in Downers Grove. For more information, click events at IllinoisFamily.org.
Nothing compares to a good marriage and predicting happiness for Americans.
The IFI Worldview Conference. Click events at IllinoisFamily.org.
Where we have have healthy marriage, we have healthy communities, healthy culture. And what we need to do is strengthen and encourage marriage in America. And we begin by teaching that to our youth.
The High Calling of Marriage and Families, the IFI Worldview Conference, Saturday, March 8th at Belmont Bible Church in Downers Grove. For more information, click events at IllinoisFamily.org. IllinoisFamily.org. Thanks for joining Illinois Family Spotlight. Here's a brief interview with author Scott Klusendorf. He's the president of the Life Training Institute. We begin with a question about how to speak to state lawmakers about ending taxpayer funding of abortions in Illinois through the state's Medicaid program.
There's two things you want to do. The first is you want to make a public good argument. It is not good to force citizens in large measure to pay for something they find morally reprehensible. And I think that argument can resonate with people who might not even be fully pro-life, but have enough marginal pro-life sentiment to at least understand where we're coming from. The second thing you want to do is make the point that because abortion intentionally takes the life of an innocent human being, it's wrong and the state should not be permitting it, let alone funding it. So those two arguments, I think, are the way you want to go. You want to make the point that it's not fair to the citizenry to force them to pay for something they find morally objectionable. And then secondly, you want to make the moral question that, hey, it's wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being, and using tax dollars to do it makes it even worse.
Some would say, and I've had people call into the IFI office and say, you know what, abortion is bad, but when we have all these low-income folks having babies out of wedlock, it forces taxpayers to pay for that mistake. What do you say to that?
Well, they would never advocate killing two-year-olds who are too expensive. And the question you want to put to them is, when human beings get expensive, can we kill them? Notice they're assuming the unborn aren't human. They haven't argued for it. They're simply assuming it. They would never advocate that it would be okay to kill a two-year-old so the culture could save more money. But they will argue that way with a fetus because they're assuming the unborn is not human like that two-year-old. So we want to bring it back to the question, what is the unborn? Is the unborn one of us? If so, the unborn should not be killed just because they're expensive.
It kind of goes back to one of the arguments you've made about how to simplify the abortion debate.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, the abortion debate is not about choice, privacy, trusting women, poverty, or controlling one's body. Every one of those arguments assume the unborn are not one of us. Nobody would say we should trust women to make their own decisions about killing their two-year-olds. They only argue that way when it comes to the fetus. But again, they're assuming, they're not arguing for it. So the debate is not about choice. It's not about privacy. It's about one question. What is the unborn? And we know what the unborn is. The science of embryology is clear. They are distinct, living, whole human beings, and they don't differ from us in ways that justify killing them. Just because they're smaller, less developed, have yet to grow, have yet to have interests we can measure, does not mean they're less valuable and human than us.
It's settled science.
Yes, correct. Exactly. Yeah, that's the science of embryology.
Wrote an article about three ways the life movement can help end abortion. And for one thing, you say that we have to be full-time pro-life apologists.
Right now, if you look at the sad state of where we are, there are more people working full-time to kill children than there are working full-time to save them. Saving babies is hugely expensive, while killing them is hugely profitable. In fact, it's so expensive that large numbers of people who say they oppose abortion don't lift a finger to stop it. And those that do lift a finger often do just enough to salve the conscience, but not enough to stop the killing. Look at the other side. They're staffed by professional doctors, news media people, educators, lawyers, politicians. Our side is staffed by part-time volunteers who are trying to fit in a little pro-life work while they're busy raising kids. Who's going to win long-term with that scenario? Not us. So we need more full-time people who are willing to step up and say, I would like to make a case for life. I'd like to work full-time doing this, either supporting my local crisis pregnancy center, being a pro-life spokesperson, helping a Right to Life group out, but we're going to need more full-time people.
And one of the other points you make is that you got to systematically educate young people on the pro-life issue.
Right. And if you go to your local Catholic high school, local Protestant high school, you'll see almost no training being done in pro-life apologetics, nothing being done equipping these students to make a case for life out there in a hostile culture where people don't share their worldview. We're going to have to turn that around. We've got to systematically target these schools, equip our own kids to make the case for life on hostile turf, and if we just assume someone else is going to do it, it isn't going to happen.
Going visual, opening the casket on abortion.
Yeah.
Another point you made.
Yeah, you've got to show people abortion. They'll continue to marginalize it as a preference issue like choosing chocolate ice cream over vanilla until they see it. When they see it, it moves it from the preference side of the ledger to, uh-oh, this is a moral question I've got to confront.
How do folks connect with Scott Klusendorf?
ProLifeTraining.com, all one word, ProLifeTraining.com. That's our website.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here. God bless you.
Scott Klusendorf, the president of the Life Training Institute. Please support the work of the Illinois Family Institute. All donations are tax deductible. To give, click donate at illinoisfamily.org. When you visit, sign on for IFI email updates and check out our events page. That's illinoisfamily.org. Please tell your family and friends about Illinois Family Spotlight. Until next time, stay healthy, stay active, and God bless.
For more information about Illinois Family Spotlight, visit ifiaction.org. And to email questions and comments, do so at feedback@ifiaction.org.